Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Steve Roberts, sitting in today for Diane Rehm. She'll be back tomorrow. Emily Dickinson described heaven as that which, quote, we cannot reach. Notions about heaven vary widely, but the desire for life after death is universal across religious faiths and throughout history. The religion editor for Newsweek has written a new book that explores ancient theologies as well as modern-day views of Jewish, Muslim, and Christian believers to answer the question, what is heaven? It's titled Heaven, and the author, Lisa Miller, joins me in the studio. Welcome, Lisa.
I'm happy to be here.
You can join our conversation with Lisa Miller at 1-800-433-8850. drshow@wamu.org is our email address. We already have some coming in, so obviously this is a subject people are interested in. First obvious question, why write a book on this subject? I know you're a religion writer, but you describe what you want this book to accomplish as sort of, you use the word, you want it to be a mirror and a guide. Talk about this.
Right. Well, 80% of Americans say they believe in heaven. And so the initial question is that just because a pollster is calling them up at dinner and saying, do you believe in heaven? And they want to be optimistic rather than pessimistic, right. And they want to get off the phone? Or do they really believe in heaven? And if they do, what is it exactly that people believe? And my hunch was going into this project that though people hope for something more than the end of everything when they die, they don't have a clear idea either of what they believe or what their traditions teach them. We've grown away from our religious traditions to a great degree in America. And so
even though America is considered a very religious country.
That's true, but and many of us do still go to church regularly, but more of us do not. And so we cobble together images of heaven from what we learned in Hebrew school, what we learned in Sunday school, what our grandparents told us, what our parents told us, songs, poems, paintings.
Pop culture,
right. Defending your life is something, the Albert Brooks movie, is something that people talk about a lot when they talk about images of heaven. The David Byrne song, Heaven, we make it whatever it is that we want it to be.
Cartoons in The New Yorker, St. Peter at the Pearly Gates. I mean, we all are filled with these images.
The Simpsons is obsessed with heaven, and right. there are more episodes of The Simpsons about heaven than you can possibly imagine. So, yeah, it's everywhere. And yet, if you took yourself by the shoulders and said, what is it that I think is going to happen after I die? Most people, I think, have a very inchoate answer to that question. And so my book is an attempt to help people be more coet, if they can.
Now, here's a question you've gotten before. You've write about how uncomfortable it makes you, so therefore, of course, I'm going to ask it, which is, do you believe in heaven?
The answer is yes. I started out saying...
You say in the book you don't.
I say in the book that I believe in a non-traditional heaven. I don't believe in conventional ideas of heaven. I don't believe that in heaven I'm going to get my body back the way it was when it was 30 years old. I don't believe that I'm going to have an identity or a consciousness the way I do now. I don't believe I'm going to see the people that I love in any kind of recognizable way that will hold hands and whatever the conventional images are. I leave the door open a crack for what the Orthodox call a radical act of kindness and grace on God's part. And I love ideas of heaven having to do with the striving for perfection on earth, the striving for truth, the striving for beauty, the striving for goodness that God's people do on earth.
Did your views change while doing this book?
Yeah. I mean, I became much more sure of what it is that I do believe. And I think at the beginning, my agnosticism was profound. And now I can answer the question with certainty.
But what happened in this process? Was it my sense in reading this is that you were touched deeply by some of the people of faith you talked to and that they had a big impact.
I was. And some of the people who touched me surprised me a lot. I'm thinking right now of a Trappist monk I met one beautiful July day at a monastery in central Massachusetts. He's a guy who took vows of celibacy and poverty and obedience, but also silence. So the man doesn't talk. And he's been living with a group of brothers who also don't talk for decades. He'd gotten permission from his abbot to talk with me, and the man would not stop talking. I mean,
what a surprise.
He was so excited.
A few things I want to get off my chest. Yes.
But he comes from a tradition where people pray for the souls of the dead. And he believes that it is his job on earth to pray the souls of the living and the souls in purgatory into heaven. And he is devoted to doing this all the time. And I, when I say all the time, I mean 24 hours a day. He prays in the middle of the night. He and his brothers, they do the divine office. They wake up before dawn. This is what they do. And I actually felt meeting him that if anybody's prayers could help me go to heaven, and I'm Jewish, he could. He was a universalist in a really true way. He really thought that if everybody doesn't get to heaven, then nobody will.
Give me another example of someone you met who we will meet, the readers would meet through your book that had this kind of effect.
Another one of my favorite people was a professor at Harvard Divinity School named John Levinson. He's an Orthodox Jew. He would call himself a traditionally observant Jew. He doesn't like the Orthodox label. But he has spent his career trying to teach people that resurrection, that is the physical reuniting of body and soul at the end of time, is actually a Jewish idea and embedded in the Jewish tradition, and that we in sort of conservative and reform Judaism have lost this idea of bodies in heaven and in resurrection, but that you can't actually believe in an afterlife without it. And so I went to his office, and he was charming and slightly crabby and twinkling-eyed Harvard professor guy, door covered with New Yorker cartoons. And I was very literalistic and sort of journalistic and saying, you know, okay, so what? So how does that work? So God, can God really put together a body that's been pulverized in war or burned or drowned? And he said to me, and he just gave me this beautiful smile, and he said to me, you know, we're not talking about a lab at MIT here. We're not talking about, you know, if I had a lab at MIT, how would I put a body back together again? We're talking about a supernatural act of grace or kindness on God's part. And I thought, oh, we're talking about faith here. We're talking about putting your belief in something really profound, bigger than yourself. And that was an idea that I felt that I could get behind a little bit. I mean, this man is as rationalistic and as established a person as you can possibly meet. And he was giving me a lesson about faith, and I really appreciated it.
Well, that is such an interesting theme in the book, which is we live in a very rationalistic and scientific age. Space exploration, to take one example, has had to have had tremendous impact on the ability of ordinary people to imagine a heaven in the traditional sense of up in the clouds somewhere. And really, what you're writing about is sort of the attempt to balance our rationalist tradition with an act of faith.
Right. I'm the daughter of a scientist, and I am a skeptic and a journalist, and I am not somebody who submits very easily to magical thinking. One of the other people I met was a guy named Owen Gingrich, who's an astrophysicist at Harvard. And I went to him because he's also a believer, a Christian believer, and I wanted him to tell me where in the sky God lived. If heaven was in the sky with God, could he imagine that? And again, he was like Levinson. He sort of looked at me and he said, look, I'm an astrophysicist. I can tell you that there are places in the sky that we can't see, that we can only imagine. Our telescope can't find them. But I don't think heaven is there. You know, we can't see it with a telescope. We can't see it with science. It's a whole other thing completely. And for him, the idea that there was a place somewhere that you can't see wasn't problematic because that's what he studies. He studies places in the sky that you can't see. What was problematic for him was the idea of changelessness. So you go someplace and you don't change. It's eternity, so it's forever. But human existence is characterized by change. You know, we grow older every second. We learn things. We forget things. We fall in love. We fall out of love. We eat. We sleep.
And you create new life as well.
Right. And so for him, you know, the out-of-placeness of heaven posed no logical problem. But the changelessness was the stumper. But then again, he was a man of faith. And he said, I'm going to have to leave this to the time when I find it out.
You focus on the three monotheistic traditions, but this idea also of a heaven and an afterlife is as old as humankind. I recently went to the exhibit of the Terracotta Warriors here in Washington, and here you had an emperor who had created this vast army of clay figures to escort him into the afterlife, and musicians who would play for him, and back to the oldest pharaonic tombs in Egypt, there was this sense of you can take it with you.
Right.
Where does this idea come from, or is it just as old as humankind?
It's as old as humankind. I mean, Neanderthals were buried with seeds, and the thinking is, you know, and weapons. And the thinking is, you know, they needed stuff to eat when they went to the next world. One of my favorite parts of the book was the researching of sort of pre-biblical Jewish, the people who became Jews, afterlife beliefs, because they lived among people who archaeologists call Canaanites. They were not Jews, but they had very similar houses, lifestyles, habits. And they buried their dead underneath their houses in order to take care of them, in order to keep them close, in order to be able to feed them, in order to be able to talk to them. They had ceremonies, sometimes very drunken ceremonies.
Roman graves have pipes where you pour wine down into.
That's right. That's right. In Jerusalem now, when they do, you know, when they do new construction, they're always uncovering old graves.
Lisa Miller, her book is Heaven, Our Enduring Fascination with the Afterlife. We'll get to your comments, your calls, your questions. More with Lisa Miller as soon as she and I return, so stay with us. Welcome back. I'm Steve Roberts, sitting in today for Diane, my guest this hour, Lisa Miller. She's the religion editor for Newsweek. But her new book is called Heaven, Our Enduring Fascination with the Afterlife. And you can join our conversation with Lisa, 1-800-433-8850, drshow@wamu.org. And we're talking to Lisa about how as old as this idea of an afterlife, the earliest graves anybody's ever found, they're buried with seeds or weapons. How did this idea then manifest itself in the three monotheistic religions you focus on, Christianity, Judaism, and Islam?
Right. So Jews had this idea that their relatives lived in some shady netherworld and that they needed tending to, because if they didn't tend to their relatives, really bad things could happen. But they did not, emphatically did not, have an idea that the spirits or the souls of the dead lived up in the sky with God. In fact, the opposite. In the Hebrew Bible, heaven is the place where God lives. It is not the place where people go. And when Jacob goes to sleep on his rock and he has a vision of the angels ascending and descending the ladder to heaven, he does not think to himself, oh, that looks like a nice place. I want to go there. He thinks, no, how terrifying. That is the home of God. I don't want to go there.
This is not at the right hand of the Father.
There is nothing welcoming about that picture. Heaven is a place of power, and it's the residence of God and his angels, but it is not the home of people. And then I mean, this is a long story, but just to make it concise, you know, thanks to the influence of the Egyptians, the Zoroastrians, whom the Jews came across during the Babylonian exile, and especially the Greeks, and sort of impelled by domestic crises, political crises, there was this moment in the second century BCE where the Jews developed this idea that faithfulness to Judaism, to the laws of Judaism, would, in hard times, get them heaven. There's a line in the book of Daniel that I'm paraphrasing is, you know, and the faithful among you, the righteous among you, shall live like the stars in the sky with God forever and ever. Hmm. This was a radical change from a vision of death where you just, you know, you die, you sit in a cave, you hang out forever and ever. This is a reward for staying faithful when the, you know, forces of assimilation, you know, the Greek encroachment were very, very strong, and people were trying
to... So this really presaged the Jesus story.
Definitely. And, you know, by the time Jesus came around, belief in heaven or something like heaven was, I wouldn't say commonplace, but normal, not freakish. And Jesus and his followers really took that idea and ran with it.
And the Islamic tradition also is pretty close in various ways, although you have an interesting etymology of the word paradise.
Yeah, it's a ancient Persian word coming from, again, the Zoroastrians. One of the things I love most about the Islamic heaven is its vision of paradise is so verdant. It is, if you read the Quran, it is the most lush, lavish, ripe, dripping fountains, fruits, relaxing. The Quran talks about the kinds of fabrics you'll wear in heaven, you know.
Directly opposite of their life in the harshest desert.
I mean, it was 120 degrees yeah. every single day. Life was so hard for the people who were the first Muslims that, you know, they often killed their own baby children so as not to have another mouth to feed. They were, you know, thirsty and hungry and fighting each other all the time. And it is absolutely no wonder that the heaven that it offers is a place of relaxation and ease, where you lounge on couches and you wear gold bracelets and you wear silk clothes.
And what is that? How has that evolved? I mean, I know this is a long question and you've written a long book about it, but from those conceptions in the early root phases of these religions, how have they evolved?
The answer is sort of depends on where you are on the religion spectrum. So if you tend to be sort of conservative in the conservative Orthodox group, you take the biblical descriptions and the traditional descriptions as real. And, you know, among conservative Christians in America today, the Book of Revelation is the primary text for descriptions of heaven still. And the Book of Revelation contains all of the images that we think of today as heavenly images. It has the, you know, the pearl gates and the streets of gold and the jeweled walls and the big throne and the angels and the white-clad saints. I mean, the whole picture is there. And if you're a conservative, you think of that as a real place. If you're a progressive, you tend to think of all of that language as, or most of it, as metaphorical, as stand-ins for something that we'll never understand and we won't know about until we get there. And these same differences exist in all three traditions. So Orthodox Jews do believe in a resurrection and a reuniting with relatives after death and an ascension to God in some way. And progressives, Reformed Jews, tend to be much more agnostic on that. And the same with Muslims. You know, conservative Muslims take these descriptions of paradise very, very literally. And progressives like much more poetic and metaphorical verses from the Quran to describe heaven. One intellectual I spoke to out in Silicon Valley said that he liked the verse in the Quran that described God as close to you as your jugular vein. He said, you know, for me, that's heaven, a kind of closeness with God that is so essential that he's actually inside you.
We have a number of emails from our listeners saying, compare that tradition to the Eastern religions of Buddhism, Hinduism.
There are many differences. The most obvious one that I can think of right now is that in the Western tradition, heaven is up. It's in another place. Our souls, our bodies ascend to heaven.
Right.
And
of course, with the Easter story about to be retold, we're reminded of that basic core notion.
That's right. It is up in the sky. It is beyond the sky. It is a real place. In Eastern religions, heaven, it's not really an analogous word, is everywhere. You know, the Balinese Hindus believe that God is in every grain of rice, in the trees, in the rocks, in the stones, in the grass. So the home of God isn't a separate place. I would say that's the first difference. And then, of course, there are differences like reincarnation. Although one interesting fact I learned in the research for my book is that more and more Americans are believing in reincarnation. About a third of Americans do believe in reincarnation, including a quarter of people who say that they're Christian. And traditionally, reincarnation and resurrection have been mutually exclusive ideas. But somehow people are feeling like they can conflate it, which is, you know.
Interesting. Another dimension of this, of course, is how heaven is put to use in the real world, both as a reward. I mean, in many traditions, this is a prime source of discipline and of moral teaching, that this is, you go to heaven as a reward for a good life. But we've also seen it perverted in the suicide bombers who, it's a promise of a paradise that causes them to commit mass murder. Talk about those two conflicting ideas.
Right. Well, I would argue that the most vivid images of heaven are those that are held by people who really, really want something or need something or feel, for whatever reason, that the world they're living in is dramatically unjust, rightly or wrongly. So these are the apocalyptic visions. These are the visions where, you know, the world is going to end. You, as a good soldier of God, are going to play a part in that end. You are going to help bring about the end. Justice is going to reign on earth. Truth and beauty are going to reign on earth. You will be rewarded, and you will get X, 72 virgins, streets of gold, whatever the image is in your culture. And that can be used for better and worse. I mean, in the pre-bellum South, some of the most apocalyptic visions of heaven were held by American slaves who thought that in the New World, you know, the promise mm-hmm. that the mighty would fall,
brought low,
and the meek would be raised high, was an incredibly profound idea.
Sure.
And a lot of slave spirituals sing of this. You know, the stars will fall from the sky, the meek will be raised up, you know, the mighty will fall, and you know, it's cataclysm. It's a radical reversal of the world order. So, you know, that's a completely understandable and sympathetic notion of apocalypse, right? And then on the other hand, you have, you know, the 72 virgins and the young men who believe that they are soldiers of God and that, you know, by immolating themselves, they will ascend to heaven to receive the sexual ministrations of a lot of hot chicks. If you're selling heaven to a bunch of 15-year-old boys, that seems like a very, you know, obvious place to go, if a little bit crass.
We have a lot of listeners and emailers who want to ask you some questions, so let me start with some emails. Rick in Rochester, who subject line is a skeptic's view, and fair enough. And he says a person's self is defined by personality and memory. These are supported by the brain, as evidenced by the fact that an injury to the brain can affect both personality and memory. Hence, when brain tissue is destroyed by death, so is the personality, memory, and self. Why believe in an afterlife?
This brings to mind a little section of the book that I was reading this morning about there are people who believe that heaven and all of our ideas about heaven are actually something that happens in the brain when the brain shuts down. So one theory posited by Andrew Newberg, who's a radiologist at the University of Pennsylvania, and he studies the mystical experiences of nuns and monks who are really, really good at meditating and who can get themselves into an out-of-body experience. And he posits that in death, perhaps, the sympathetic nervous system and the parasympathetic nervous system start shutting down at the same time, which gives you both a rush, which would explain why people kind of see their memories all like a movie, and also this feeling of profound calmness, which gives you this sense of out-of-body-ness. And that, you know, when people describe a tunnel with a light at the end of it, it could be your peripheral vision shutting down first to the end when you see a bright light. So there are sort of neurological explanations if you want to go that way.
I'm Steve Roberts, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Could you please ask Ms. Miller about Buddhism, writes Philip from Silver Spring, Maryland. As I understand that there is no concept of, quote, afterlife in traditional Buddhism. There is a concept of rebirth, which may or may not mean reincarnation, depending on one's interpretation.
I didn't study Buddhism for the book, so I'm not as good at Buddhism as I am at the Western traditions. But I can say that, you know, Buddhism doesn't have an up and down. It does have a sort of a cycle where you keep coming back to try again. And in perfection, you don't come back anymore. And that more and more Americans are attaching themselves to this idea because, as my friend Steve Prothero said, you know, Steve Prothero is a religion professor at Boston University and has written a lot about death and afterlife beliefs. And he said, you know, here in America, we want the here and now. Life is good, in spite of the fact that, you know, we're going through a pretty hard time in our economy. There's war. But we're a prosperous nation. We own our houses. We can get anything we want at the grocery store. You know, why would we want to go someplace else after we die? Why wouldn't we want to just come back here? That makes a lot of sense to me.
We have another email saying, the idea is that heaven is here and now. From Aaron, quote, heaven is not where you go when you die. It's where you are when your grandchild runs into your open arms and gives you a hug.
That's an idea of heaven that I really love. And in my book, in the epilogue, I talk about the moment in our house at 7:30 every morning when our daughter comes into our bed and we sort of lie there for 10 minutes, the three of us.
How old is she?
She's six. And I think to myself, this is perfection right here. There is nothing better than this. And, you know, we are so busy and so crazy and running around so much. And this is the moment of peace and stillness and perfection in our lives. And I really understand that vision of heaven. And I can really get behind it. I will say that if you take that one step farther, there's an idea in the Christian and in the Jewish and in all three Western traditions that in the liturgy, in prayer, in song, you are imitating the activities of the angels in heaven. And so if you think of heaven as a sort of parallel universe and human activity as sort of engaged in perfection and the pursuit of beauty and truth, then it's possible that we're emulating the angels in those moments. And I like that.
Frank writes to us from North Carolina. I personally believe that we are resurrected as pieces of the universe, possibly as planets or entire civilizations, as all matter shares similar properties and energy. I've read a number of quotes by Khalil Gibran that allude to a similar understanding and wonder if your guest can elaborate on such a belief and tell us if there is an organized religion that shares such views.
I can tell you that Plato believed something very much like this. The idea that the soul, which according to Plato, and actually Hindus believe this too, resides in the head. And the ultimate end of human life is the attainment of wisdom. Mm-hmm. And the body is the locus of everything that's corrupt and dirty and tainted. And so at death, the body stays in the ground to rot. You don't need your body. it is the thing that actually brings you down.
Well, of course, Hindus burn their bodies immediately
That's
after
right.
death.
And the soul, which resides in the head, ascends to God. And if the soul has been wise enough, it gets to stay with God. But if it not, it comes back down for another try. So Plato did believe in actually something like reincarnation. So this idea of souls as sort of indestructible and unique parts of human identity that all rush up together to live with God is an idea that has some roots in Western tradition.
Lisa Miller, she is the religion editor of Newsweek. She's also the author of the book we've been discussing, Heaven, Our Enduring Fascination with the Afterlife. I'm Steve Roberts, sitting in today for Diane. She'll be back tomorrow. But Lisa and I are going to be back with your phone calls and more of your questions, so stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by Constant Contact, dedicated to helping small businesses and nonprofits build strong customer relationships with email marketing. ConstantContact.com. By the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at WTGrantFoundation.org. And by MetLife Foundation, proudly supporting NPR's coverage of aging, on the web at MetLife.org. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, Mark Potok of the Southern Poverty Law Center talks about their new report, Rage on the Right, documenting the record number of hate groups in the U.S.
The changing demographics of the country, the election of a black man, the role of the government and the bailouts. These are some of the things that have really helped these groups grow in an extraordinary way.
Join us.
Welcome back. I'm Steve Roberts, sitting in today for Diane, and my guest this hour is Lisa Miller. She's the religion editor of Newsweek. She's written a book called Heaven, Our Enduring Fascination with the Afterlife. And Lisa, a number of emails have, like Nick's from Reston, Virginia, in one form or another say, how does the concept of hell fit in with the concept of heaven? Is it ethical to send people to hell? What is hell actually like? And others have written in saying, can you have a heaven without a hell?
People have asked me why I didn't write a book about hell, because everybody says Dante's Inferno is so much better than his Paradiso, and that people really want to read about hell. In the old days, you had to have heaven and hell, although belief in hell is declining like crazy in America. Only a small fraction of people say they believe in hell. And of course, nobody thinks that they are going to hell. So even of those people who do believe in hell, they're not going there. More and more people are becoming universalist, which means that they think everybody's going to go to heaven somehow. And more traditions are looking for ways to interpret their scriptures as universalist.
Because a lot of the harsher traditions are you have to believe to be saved, and that excludes non-believers.
That's right. There was a really interesting study by the Pew Forum on Religion and Public Life a couple years ago where they asked about this question of salvation. And the question was something like, Is there one path to God or many? And a huge number of people, 70% or something like that, said that they believed that there were many paths to God, including a surprising number of evangelical Christians. So even people who are taught in Sunday school that Jesus Christ is the only way want to leave some wiggle room for other people. I wrote a piece for Newsweek called We Are All Hindus Now, which was sort of a flip way of saying, you know, we are increasingly open to different ways of salvation. And it is by far one of the most popular stories on Newsweek.com. It got something like 4,000 comments or something in 2 days. This idea that, you know, we're not going to be restrictive about salvation anymore is really a profound idea in our culture right now. And I think it's only going more in that direction.
Do you think that to some extent relates to the fact that so many tribes marry out and that people have family members who they dearly love who are not within their religious tradition?
Well, I mean, you know, I am one of those people, so I...
Me too.
Yeah, I think that's part of it. I think it's also just part of globalization. You know, we have neighbors who are unlike us. We no longer live in an Episcopalian neighborhood or a Jewish neighborhood or a Catholic neighborhood. We can, as Roger Kamenetz, who wrote The Jew and the Lotus, once said to me, you know, we can look over the wall and see what everybody else is doing. And the internet makes it even easier. So you're interested in Zoroastrianism or you're interested in Jainism or you're interested in Hinduism.
You have a neighbor who practices that.
It's simple. And so... And also, I think with the growing popularity of aspects of Eastern religion, people are really willing to cobble together religious identities in a way that was just not done 20 years
Sure.
ago. And so that makes us much more open. As I say, even in the most conservative parts of our culture, to other ways of thinking about salvation. You know, even the evangelist Billy Graham told my boss, John Meacham, in an interview that, you know, for him, Jesus was the only way to heaven, but he wasn't going to make any judgments about who was going to get to go.
Let's turn to some of our callers. Rachel in Birmingham, Alabama, you've been waiting patiently. We appreciate it. You're on the air. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Hi, Lisa. I've never listened to the show before. I just happened to turn it on today at the office and heard you talking about the things, but I just wanted to ask a question. You've got a little girl at home, and would you want her to believe in whatever she wanted to believe in, or do you think there's one truth?
That's a two-part question. The first part is, do I want her to believe in whatever she wants to believe in? And the answer is no. I grew up Jewish. I'm very proud. I have a strong Jewish heritage, although I didn't have a strong Jewish education as a child. I'm sending my daughter to Hebrew school, and we sent her to a Jewish preschool because it was really important for me to teach her the history of her people and the scriptures and the prayers and the songs and the tradition.
Do you believe there's one God?
I believe that I believe that there are many paths to God, and I believe that, from here on earth, we can't say, you know, what the one truth is. If you're a native African living in a country that's never been exposed to, if you're an animist and you've never been exposed to Christianity or Islam or Judaism or Buddhism or Hinduism, and you have a primitive religion that goes back to for hundreds, thousands of years, who are we to say that that's not, you know, truth?
But that to me is the problem, because it is not, you know, it doesn't really matter what my opinion is or yours or really any person's, because there is only one truth, and God did write it down, and he did say, well, in Romans, he says, no one will have an excuse when they stand before him, because he has written it in the skies. There is one God. We all know. And then it's a question of, do we seek the one true God, or do we make up our own God? You know, and he has made a way for us to know the truth. And every question that you're talking about, that I've heard you talking about, is already written down for us to know that, yes, Jesus Christ is the only way, and that's why God wants us to know that we are loved so much that he came for us himself and died to pay for our sins and rose again to show us that we would walk through those doors of heaven and that there is a place. And when we leave here, every single one of us will stand before God. You will stand before him as a child of his, or you will stand before him with his wrath. You know, in John 3:36, it says, those that have the Son have life, and those without the Son have not life, but the wrath of God abides on them.
Thank you very much, Rachel, for your call. We appreciate it. Lisa, you have a reaction to
Rachel. Oh, sorry. I was going to say that I am very sympathetic to Rachel's point of view, and I know that there are a lot of people out there who say...
We've gotten a lot of emails expressing a similar point of view.
Right, who say... You know, this is what the Bible says, and this is not a matter of interpretation or subjectivity or
choice.
This is real, and this is truth. I don't believe that I am going to hell because my grandparents and their grandparents and their grandparents before them didn't accept Jesus Christ, and I don't believe that a lot of the good people in my life are going to hell for that reason. So I'm not going to go there. But I am extremely sympathetic to the people who believe that. And I would just suggest that we leave these questions in abeyance until which time we know the truth.
Let's turn to Chris in Rayford, North Carolina, with a different point of view. Chris, you're on the Diane Rehm Show.
Hey, thanks for taking the call. I have two things. One, real quick, let me just throw this out there. I think it needs to be out. Do people who call the Bible, who look at that and say, this is the truth, it's already there, do they not think about the fact that people, Muslims, for instance, feel the exact same way about their book? That's just what I want to say. But as an atheist, I don't really believe in a heaven, hell, or afterlife, or God, or at least to the extent that it doesn't matter. But I think that brings up the point of, isn't life more precious? If this is the only time that we have, you know, George Carlin has a great bit about the ultimate goal of a Christian is to die. And I, as a former believer, I don't subscribe to that, but it's a funny bit. And it gets to that idea of, shouldn't we enjoy the time we have here? Shouldn't we make this the best? Shouldn't we not say, things are going to be so much better when I die? Why don't we make it the best for ourselves and for everyone around us while we're here?
Chris, thanks so much for your call. We really appreciate it. Lisa?
I would say that the one word in your question that I would argue with is enjoy. There are many branches of progressive Christianity, Judaism, Islam, which would agree with you to a point, which is, you know, let's work together to make this world as good a place as we can. And then they would add, because Christ wants us to live this way, because Christ wants us to take care of each other, to take care of the poor, to make sure that everybody has enough, to make sure that we're treating each other without selfishness, to make sure that we're treating each other with humility, to make sure...
Well, this is the salvation through good works, doctor.
Yeah, I mean, there was a whole... In the early 20th century, there was a whole school of thought... Niebuhr, Rauschenberg, who were talking about the social gospel.
Social gospel.
And
yes.
The social gospel led to the civil rights movement. There were people who were talking about it recently in the healthcare reform debate. You know, so these ideas of salvation in heaven come back to how we treat each other on earth. And you know, I think that that's a perfectly acceptable way to think about heaven. And as I said earlier, I think, you know, it, just to push it one step farther, you could say, you know, that's the way that God wants us to live. That's the way we live most like God.
Let's turn to Leonard in Mishawaka, Indiana. Leonard, welcome to the Diane Rehm Show.
Thanks. I'm a Lutheran pastor, and I've been overseas in Finland and Hong Kong studying emerging Christianity. And what emerging Christianity says is that we live in a post-linear age, and in the linear age, with a lot of verbiage, we were able to take stands that were in black and white, and in the post-linear age, we are more open and contemplative and listening to one another because of technology that's included in that. So this is known as non-dualistic thinking in a post-linear age. And I'm wondering if you're aware of the emerging Christianity.
Yes, I am. And I think that it's a very exciting movement, the emerging church in Christianity. I would just add, though, that there are parts of the world that are emphatically not post-linear and where people are living and dying for linear religion. And so this seems to me to be a product of, you know, prosperity, material wealth, democracy, justice, which allows us to be generous in our interpretations toward others' religions. And in places where life is not like that, that generosity doesn't exist so much.
Right, but also in America, there's fundamentalism that's very tied to a literalism or the linear approach, exclusive approaches to faith. And I think maybe in America it can be divided between fundamentalism and a more liberal viewpoint among religions, not necessarily just Christianity.
Thanks very much for your call, Leonard. I'm Steve Roberts, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Time for maybe one or two more. And Rigoberto in Fort Lauderdale, welcome. You're on The Diane Rehm Show.
Yes, hi. Thank you for taking my call. I just have a brief comment. From my belief, and I may be a bit cynical, but I choose not to believe in neither heaven nor hell. For the main reason that I see that a lot of people take those aspects just as a mean to feel that they need to do certain things in order to get to heaven, more as a reward instead of, you know, living right for goodness sake. So the way I take my life, I don't choose to believe in a heaven or a hell because of an outcome. If I do something good, it's because I want to do good for that very reason. If I, you know, I do something that may not be seen as good, you know, I don't choose to believe that I'm going to be ultimately punished for that.
Thanks for your call.
People say, people talk a lot about what did Jesus mean when he said the kingdom is now. Did he mean the world is about to end any minute and we better get right with God because the sky is falling? Or did he mean with my arrival here on earth, we are all going to start living like God's people? So the kingdom of God is now. So I guess, you know, this sort of defines the liberal conservative spectrum, and people fall all different places along it. And these two visions aren't actually mutually exclusive. It sounds like you are a little bit on the progressive side of things, but you know, there's room for all different ways of interpreting that.
And it's certainly true that the promise of a heavenly reward has been, in many ways, a civilizing impulse, where it has also been used, as you point out, to reward dastardly behavior as well. But it cuts both ways.
That's right. I mean, you know, 72 virgins is a strong enticement for a 15-year-old boy who people want to blow himself up. But it's also, you know, huge consolation, you know, the idea of family reunions in heaven for people who are about to lose someone they love.
Now, that leads me to my final question. I only got about a minute, because you talk very movingly about the death of your grandfather. While not believing in a traditional heaven, you did have a vision of his return. And tell us that story.
I was very, very close to my grandparents. They lived in New York. They were Holocaust. They escaped the Nazis in 1940. My mom was a little girl. And I moved to New York in my early 20s, and I spent a lot of time with them at their apartment. They would cook me dinner, take me shopping, take me to the theater. I was very, very close to them. I was with my grandfather when he died, and I was extremely moved by that experience. And then I met the man who I was going to marry. And he is not Jewish. And I was having nothing to do with his religion. I was sort of a skittish late bride and anxious. And I was sorry that my grandfather had not met I was sorry that my grandfather had not met Charlie. And then several weeks before our wedding, I woke up and I saw my grandfather sitting at the foot of my bed. And he looked well, and his eyes were sparkling, and he touched my arm. And I felt in that moment that I'd gotten his blessing, and that he was saying to me, you know, Charlie's a good guy. You're doing the right thing. I love you. And, you know, under the chuppah, when you get married, the idea is that all of your family is there holding up the poles. And I felt in our ceremony that he was there, too. So he's with me.
Lisa Miller, her book is Heaven, Our Enduring Fascination with the Afterlife. Thank you so much for joining us on the Diane Rehm Show this morning.
Thank you, Steve.
I'm Steve Roberts, sitting in today for Diane. She'll be back tomorrow. And we're delighted you spent part of your morning with us. Thank you.